I think for me, you know, your first year in the Peloton, you know, it's almost exciting. You're always getting interviews, you know, you're getting new followers on Instagram, all this, like, whatever, you kind of get sucked into that. But what I've realized, especially this year, is I never raced my bike or wanted to race my bike so I could be in cycling news. Like, it's not the media for me. Is I understand that it's part of the job, and for our sponsors, we have to do it. And, you know, you just accept it that way, but it's not really anything that I care about. You know, the more I race, the more I realize that, you know, forget the money, forget anything. You know, it's just because I want to win the biggest races in the world for me, not even for anyone else, really. Like, it's not to prove anything. It's to prove to myself that I can reach that level.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo.
Yeah.
This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I've wanted to have this interview for a long time, a couple of years actually, and tried to make it happen via some of the professional channels that typically one has to schedule through when having a conversation with a world tour rider, but with pretty limited success. And so I finally said, you know what, screw it. I'm just going to reach out to Quinn directly. We live in the same town after all. We see each other under the Tuesday night group ride fairly frequently. And I was really game that he hit me back quickly and said, you bet, I'd be happy to. And so he drove up the hill. We did this conversation in person in the studio here in Durango. And I'm so thrilled that he was willing to do so. I don't know that Quinn's ever done a long form interview like this. Some may be aware that he has a little bit of a checkered past in regards to interacting with the media. And, you know, I think there's a chance that I'll get some messages about some people feeling certain ways about doing this interview. And frankly, I'm not here to do the job of cycling news or do the job of Velo News or whoever else. I'm here to do a different job. And we talk about some of the stumbles that Quinn has had in the past on and off the bike. And I'm really grateful that he was willing to discuss that. And we also talk about a lot of other stuff. And ultimately what I wanted to do was give all of y'all the chance to get to know the person behind all of this talent, get to know the person behind the headlines. So I'm really grateful that he was game for that opportunity as well. I hope you come away having a greater depth of feel for one of the greatest talents that our country has seen in a while. And maybe it'll even get you excited to follow some of his racing coming back as he returns from illness. Wishing him all the best as he jumps back into the highest level of cycling that we have. I want to say a big thank you to Therabody today for supporting the episode. They have their all new Recovery Air Jet boots that they just sent us recently. And I remember back when I was a junior racer wanting these, what to me looked like NASA level astronaut space boots. And I remember thinking, oh man, all the pros have these and I would love to have my own. That would be so cool. That would be so pro. But unfortunately, there are thousands of dollars. No more. The world's most advanced pneumatic compression system ever is now more accessible than ever. You know, for years, runners, bikers, and everyone who spends hours on their feet have had to suffer through leg pains and aches after hard, long days. But thanks to clinically proven treatments like the compression boots that pro athletes have been using for a while, that's now in reach. It used to be out of reach. Like I said, when I was a junior, it felt very out of reach, but now it's in reach for just about everybody. And Recovery Air is a groundbreaking pressure massage for everybody, anywhere. Therabody's exclusive fast flush technology, Recovery Air, flushes out metabolic waste more fully and brings back fresh blood to your legs at three times the speed of competitors. Their recovery air jet boots are the first of their kind. They're truly wireless, super cool, which makes on-the-go recovery much easier, boosting circulation and radically reducing muscle soreness. And thanks to recovery air, super intuitive, easy to use, one-touch controls, recovering faster is a breeze. So here's the crazy good news. These are now available for just $699. That's like a quarter of what this technology used to cost, you know, however long ago when I first was really dreaming of having my own set. You can also get them for $59 a month with Affirm. Plus, with Recovery Air 60-day money-back guarantee and free shipping, there's really no risk. Just go to therabody.com/adventure. That's all caps, adventure. I also want to say a big thank you to Dometic. As I mentioned last week, they've got some really cool new products coming. I talked about their camping gear, their chairs, their tables that Nicole and I put an order in recently to set up our race venue hangout zone. But they also have some new stuff coming, like their new Dometic Go water hydration jugs. It's this 11-liter, obviously reusable hydration jug. And one thing that Dometic's really been leaning into that I appreciate is reducing single-use plastics and creating technology that's more earth-friendly, durable, long-lasting, and also just more efficient. They have a product called the Dometic Go Hydration Water Faucet that pairs with the Go Hydration 11-liter jug. That's portable, and it's a self-powered water faucet, so you can reduce water waste, you know, whether you're camping and want to brush your teeth or, you know, wash pots and pans, whatever it is, it allows you to dispense what you need and use less. And one thing I've noticed, whether camping or being at the races, just having water kind of out and available is so helpful in terms of just staying hydrated too. So we went ahead and ordered one of these Dometic Go water hydration jugs with the hydration water faucet as well. If you want 15% off any and all of Dometic's awesome outdoor products, from coolers to, you know, water jugs to camping gear, whatever it is, just go to Dometic.com and use code AdventureStash. That's all caps, AdventureStash, for 15% off anything in their outdoor catalog. Super cool. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you after the show. Weather's been crazy here, huh?
The wind.
Dude. We have like racks of wood up on the deck. An entire rack of wood just blew over an hour ago. It's a good day to have a rest day. We're both on a rest day, right?
Yep.
Easy day?
Yep.
Quinn, you are... Well, first of all, I've been wanting to do this a long time. About a year and a half, at least. And reached out to the folks that I thought would make it happen, but it just wasn't happening. So I finally just reached out to you directly and you're like, yeah, let's do it. And that was the main thing, is I just wanted to make sure you were game. And yeah, here we are finally. And we're getting to do it in person because you're home in Durango during a time of year when typically you wouldn't be, right? You should be over in Europe right now.
I should have flown home yesterday, actually.
Back here.
Yeah.
You're going to have a break now. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. But point is, you've been home for, or back in the States for, couple few weeks, three
two
weeks?
Weeks now
two weeks
two weeks yeah
You start out the year super strong, obviously crushed it at Torino. I had fun tuning into GCN every morning and watching you take out the mountains classification at that one. I think that one, that ride probably surprised, or not surprised people, but that's not necessarily what some people expected from you who is prepping for the classics. We can kind of get into that too, but sure. Anyway, year started out strong, and then once things rolled into your actual classics campaign, you kind of had some bad luck, health stuff, all that sort of thing, and had to put a pause on your year. Can you talk a little bit about kind of what happened and where you are right now with things?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I went with the Italian block, so I do Strada Torino, and then we meet together with the guys who do Paris-Nice and San Remo for the main classics, and I think everyone's seen in the news that pretty much the whole peloton's been sick at some point. And for me, it was my turn the week after Torino. And then, you know, I think maybe just a bit too early of a comeback to come to the Belgian races. And from there, I just basically racing with the sickness I had caused a lung infection somehow. And from there, I had to come home and go through some treatment to get back on the bike. It ended up being almost 3 weeks of rest just starting again last weekend to start riding. So kind of threw away all the main goals of the spring, but now we look forward, and I have Swiss in June will be the first event back. So still 6 weeks now to rebuild.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of crazy how many people have been getting sick. It seems like, with everyone having to wear masks for so long, everyone's immune system's just like forgot how to deal with illnesses, and everyone's getting sick, whether it's COVID or anything really.
Yeah. No, I think we were reading like some of the teams, most teams have 30 guys, and at some point there were 20 guys sick on teams.
Dude.
I mean, Israel didn't even start Flanders because they didn't have enough guys to start. So it's definitely, it's been a weird year.
Yeah. That's intense. So how frustrating is it? Cause I mean, you've been pretty vocal about Roubaix kind of being like your, I don't know. Is it fair to say that it's like number one on your wish list in regards to getting a result at?
It's definitely top three for sure. I mean, you can't really pick between like a Flanders, a Roubaix, or a world champion. I think anyone would be happy with any of them. But yeah, it was a focus for this year. And then this year also too, is the schedule is a bit changed. So we were able to race Amstel before Roubaix, which in my opinion was an advantage for us bigger guys who wanted to actually race Amstel. So that was a goal that I missed out on. And then also to miss Flanders, you know, it's never a good thing. You know, we work from November 1st for that 1 week where we have those three races, and to miss all three of them, you know, only 5 days away from starting that week, it's not so nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's that first week like when you're, you know, sitting at home assessing, like, are you just super pissed? Are you disappointed? Are you at a point in your career now where you know that this is just part of it and you can like accept it easier? What's that whole mental process like?
Well, after Torino, I had one day where I felt okay and then started to feel it the next day. But, you know, the week of Torino is the biggest training load, if you look at TSS, that I've ever done. So I was thinking, okay, whatever, I have 2-3 easy days, it's fine. Then it was like a week of nothing. I'm like, oh, I'll still be okay. Then you start to ride again and you're like, I can save this. It's only been a week off. And, you know, from that point, you still have 2 weeks till Roubaix. So, you know, you stay focused, you still eat right. You know, the whole time I was sick, I made sure to really, you know, not give up or anything. Just stayed on it with the diet, everything. And then you go to the races, and three times I raced, and I don't think the furthest I made it was 120K. When you're doing 240K races, that's not so much.
Yeah.
And then every time, you know, you're stuck there, you finished, but then you still have normally like an hour on the bike to get back to the bus, or ride in the car back to the bus, or just this whole like 3-hour show of like just disappointment after you've pulled out of the race and trying to find your way home. And then you watch the finish on the bus and you see the guys, you know, up there racing that, you know, on a good day you can be there. So that part really hurts. And then I think the worst one was at Dors de Vlaanderen when we were doing, you know, I was actually feeling quite okay and was there for the first time ever when the move went. You know, I'd always really struggled with positioning. It's never been my legs to let me down. And then I finally was in the correct position and just straight up wasn't strong enough. The group that won was the 8 guys who were rode away in front of me. And then that one, you ride back in the car to the bus and you watch the finish and just knowing you could have been there on a good day. And well, that hurts. But then we decided to pull out of Flanders for me, and I'd go back to Girona thinking I would have, you know, 10 days to prepare for Amstel, sleep in my altitude tent, do everything. And I just woke up the morning after travel sick again. And from there is 3 days where I barely left the apartment. And then I called my coach. I'm like, yeah, this isn't working. I want to go home. Because at that point, it's almost 2 weeks of nothing. Then to think you can even be useful in Roubaix it's not a great idea. And to prolong it any longer is just going to end up hurting the summer.
For sure. For sure. And what is it about coming back to the States, to Durango, that feels like the right move? I mean, I know you have a tight-knit family. You have 2 other brothers or one?
Just one.
One other brother. Yeah. Colby, who we'll talk about eventually. And, you know, you grew up going on mountain adventures with your family, still do that. Is it more of like a strong family tie thing, or just being back in the States and those creature comforts that the United States doesn't have, that, you know, a lot of times you have to sacrifice in Europe that kind of help during a period like that?
It's definitely both. I think especially Europeans don't understand how hard it is for us to be over there, especially when things aren't going right. you know, with even with the time change and everything, you still, if you want to talk to people back here, it's only part of the afternoon where you can do it. And then, yeah, here, you know, I have everything. I can ride, do the group rides. I can ride with my dad. I have people to ride with. Can ride my gravel bike. It's just, it's different. And for me, the training is almost easier to do on our roads. You know, it's more straightforward. I go to Park City in 10 days from now. And from there, it's just somewhere I can settle into routine. I'm at altitude. You have 5 45-minute long climbs, flat routes. You have a group ride, people to ride with. You know, the food's normal. You go to your grocery store and you like actually can pick out what you want. You know, have a car, everything just so much easier. And then for me, the biggest reason I come back is for the altitude. I don't know why. I think maybe because I was born here or whatever, but for me, it makes a really big difference to have that training block and, you know, really a long time to actually prepare well for races. I like, you know, a lot of guys race into fitness, but for me, I'd rather just train super hard, go behind the scooter, everything. And then you can come in, you're skinny, you're fast, you're happy. Then you fly over there and, for me, the jet lag's not a problem, so I can fly in and race the next day and feel good.
Oh, wow. Huh. Yeah. Yeah, that whole altitude thing is interesting because I feel like Sepp's kind of similar in that regard. Obviously, he lives in Andorra and, you know, grew up at altitude. But then there's some guys like Chris Blevins who it seems like they need sea level. I know I need sea level. It just kind of, yeah, that is an interesting one.
Yeah, for me, like, to do an intensity workout once you're down, I can do almost the exact same here as I can do at sea level. So there's no sacrifice in the intensity.
Like numbers wise, you can.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
For within like 4 or 5%. Yeah.
Wow. Are you talking like, I don't know, like 1 minute, 1 minute on, 1 minute off, same numbers or like 20 minute sweet spot?
The 1 minutes would be a bit lower, but yeah, for 25 to 20 minutes, I can push almost the same once that's you're fully crazy. Adapted. Yeah.
That's so insane. I've never been within like 10%. It's wild. Yeah. Huh. That's super interesting. And you mentioned Park City. You like it there mostly just because of the nature of the climbs, just like good.
The climbs, you know, really good mountain biking on the rest days. It's just something different. You know, I like being in Durango, but I've rode a road bike here for 10 years now or so. It's nice to change it up. And for me, when I go somewhere and I'm renting a place and I just have 1 month where I'm there only to train, you know, I have a gym and go to a sauna, you know, it's just, that's all you do. It's really easy to turn on that focus for that 1 month and just do nothing other than to prepare. And that'd be a bit harder to do here, especially, you know, with all the different things around. So, you know, in my head, I'm always a bit more lax until I go to that, whether it's there or I go to Silver City in the winter or whatever, you know, I always set aside 1 month at altitude where I do nothing other than try and get fast.
For sure. You mentioned Park City as a good, group ride as well.
Yeah, there's a Wednesday Worlds.
Nice. Yeah. So how would you characterize Durango Tuesday Worlds versus Tucson Shootout versus Park City Wednesday Worlds?
I think, you know, it hurts me to admit it, but I'd have to say that Tucson wins. Yeah. You know, it's hard to beat a Saturday shootout, especially middle of the winter when we're all there.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the hardest hours. I think my peak 40-minute effort actually for the last 3 years has always come on the shootout, not from a race.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But no, Tuesday night, you know how it is. For the last 10 years, I've always done it when I could, or not 10, maybe. How long have I been going? 8 years, maybe.
Dude, I remember when you were about 4'8" and 100 pounds.
Yeah, I think I was 14 when I started. So okay. It's been a while, 7 years or so.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the Wednesday one in Park City, it's a bit more low-key, but when Keegan's around and guys like Griffin and, you know, we can talk some other the locals to come out, and it's still a nice same deal as here, 5:30, you meet, you get an extra hour and a half of training. For me, it's my perfect training is when I'm here, can do a long ride before the group ride and then just finish with it. And, I mean, it's not the same, but it's as close to power you can simulate doing a long world tour race because totally. In training, you can't do 5 hours and then kill yourself for an hour and a half. It's a lot easier with a group.
Yeah, and it kind of depends on who's in town, too. Like, if Blevins and Howie are in town, it's obviously pretty dang quality, yeah. But still only, what, like 15 people?
Yeah.
It's funny how high the level is with how few people are in that group, right, a lot of times. But let's talk a little bit about, I guess, speaking of Durango and you growing up here and everything, I guess your trajectory is kind of interesting to me because, obviously, we have kind of an insane amount of talent that's come out of this town. Obviously, it's got a crazy history, especially with mountain biking, but just even currently, you know, with Sepp coming out of here and Chris Blevins, now your younger brother, obviously loads of mountain bikers, all that sort of thing. The majority of the time, people start in Durango Devo, go into mountain biking, and then maybe switch to the road or stick with mountain biking. There aren't many riders that have just like been fully focused on the road from, I don't know, what were you, 18, 17?
When 17 you really... when I started on, I was still half mountain bike, half road when I was 17, and then my last year junior was fully on the road, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious why you decided to fully focus on the road from so early, because it's not like you, it wasn't like you struggled on the mountain bike, like you won a handful of junior national titles, right?
Yeah.
So there was promise there, obviously. Why do you think you got so interested in the road so early?
Well, I started with Whole Athlete on the mountain bike, specialized Devo team, and raced with them all the way through 17. So I did 3 years with them, 15, 16, 17. And then my first year junior when I was 17, I was also splitting it with their road team, Lux. Just, you know, that worked out with the specialized connection, and Ned helped me out a bit there. And the plan was actually just to road race as training for the mountain bike, because that was still my focus. And the first race of the year was Valley of the Sun. And I won the time trial and the road race, and then was second in the crit. You know, not really knowing what I was doing so much, just kind of racing hard. This is when I was 17.
And was that in the 1-2-3?
No, the junior.
Okay.
And then there you get invited by the national team to go to Europe. Yeah. So I worked it out that I could do the national team block, fly directly after Junior Roubaix, and then race Benelli U.S. Cup in the U.S. like 3 days later, I think. So I went over, and as soon as I started racing over there on the road, I just realized, you know, it's so much bigger of a sport. Almost. For the juniors, we started with Gent-Wevelgem, and it's in the morning of the pro race. So you're going up the Kemmelberg, just packed with people, and then you go do all the famous roads and everything, and... You know, I was third in my first race there. I'm like, okay, this is pretty cool. And then the next weekend, we did a stage race that was really, really like hardest thing I've ever done. Like, it was insane. These Belgian juniors were just racing so hard. And it was such a different style from what we're used to on hard, twisty roads, accelerating everything. You know, an American junior road race is you do a triangle with three corners and sprint. So it was really different, but I liked how hard it was. And then the following weekend was Junior Roubaix, which is also in the morning, the pro race. So you ride the last, I think, 16 sectors or so, and then you finish in the velodrome just full of people. And, you know, it's pretty hard as a fan of the sport to do that and not want to come back. Yeah. And then I raced on the mountain bike. It was, you know, okay, but you're racing three or four guys max, really competing. One of them, who is also my really good friend, racing on the road. We then went back with the national team together, and, you know, you have, you know, the stage races and everything, and you just kind of get sucked into it. It's like, okay, I like this. Went and did junior nationals, did the short track, the cross country, and then the road race 2 days later, because we just drove to Maryland, and I won all three. And then I was at a point like, okay, what do I want to do? You know, you got to focus. My last year, 18, I was thinking, okay, I want to be a pro. I know that, but I have to decide what I want to do, which way I want to go. And then I think the day I made the decision was when I realized I'd be over on my visa days and I couldn't race both world champs. And I chose, then I chose the road one. And I think that's really when I made the decision to go with the road racing.
Huh. Interesting.
And then my 18 year was the first year I fully focused and didn't race a mountain bike at all.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, most people know that like there's just more job opportunities.
That's the other thing too, is too.
Higher ceiling.
Yeah.
And also just more room for people. Yeah. Like making it on the World Cup is so, I mean, just look at Sepp.
Yeah.
Like it's pretty incredible to see. I mean, he had some promising mountain bike results for sure, but not anything that would have predicted he'd win a stage of the tour.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it's just skill sets, I feel.
And then, yeah, too, the like big show of it all kind of sucks you in, you know, the team buses, the huge crowds, watching the tour. I always watched Roubaix. I always watched the tour, you know, everything. It just, it seems like a really exciting, like big show to be on.
Yep.
It's an, pretty easy, not easy to achieve, but like it's easy goal to set. You know, you see the steps to the world tour and you just have to hit each mark and then you're there.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in terms of actually earning that contract, the obvious, like big stepping stone was Junior Worlds. Was that 19 that you won Junior World Champs?
In 2019. Yeah.
Yeah. But I heard kind of through the grapevine that actually one of the, obviously not the bigger thing, but another, aspect that really opened some doors for you, at least with Trek specifically, was your ride at Leadville, ironically. Yeah. So it was a mountain bike ride that like, you know, has some, holds some cachet. And I think it was Shriver, Matt Shriver specifically, who like knows what it takes to do a good Leadville ride.
Yeah.
And you had some bad luck at that race, but just had this insane ride where you rode through a ton of groups and finished second. Is that true that like played at least some of a role
with Trek? Yeah. I had, already in the spring and started talking with a number of teams. And then in the summer you start trying to decide, you know, if I had the option to go straight to the World Tour, but then also a few good development teams. And then, but none of the World Tour contracts were really 100% what I was looking for. And then, yeah, obviously I had asked my agent to reach out to Trek and hadn't really got much back from them. You know, they weren't super interested in taking a junior. And then after the Leadville ride, you know, is when I think only 2 or 3 days after we got a call from the boss there that they were now back into it. Cause I mean, that it makes sense that, you know, if you take a junior, you don't expect them to be good for 6 hours. So, yeah. You know, it doesn't really matter that I knew how to win races that were 3 hours. It doesn't really mean anything. But if you can do the Leadville file, and I think the biggest thing that came out of Leadville is the way I did it and the power file I got out of it. I don't think that same would have came if I just had nothing go wrong and stayed in the front group.
Just raced in the group, yeah.
I think even winning it, but having had a clean race wouldn't have had the same effect. But I think when, you know, you read a Velo News article or something that to come back from 11 minutes solo to second is, you know, that showed, for me anyways, it was showed me a new level that I could push. I'd never done a power file like that before. I never found that I could go that deep. Mm. And then I think, you know, as soon as I uploaded it, my coach at the time, Jim Miller, sent me a text and he's like, hey, you know, that's a World Tour power file. And 3 days later or so, we heard the Trek was interested.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
It's interesting too, because I mean, it's such a high race. Like, again, though, that kind of goes back to your background of growing up at elevation. So then Worlds happened. And that obviously changed things in terms of team conversations and all that sort
of thing. Well, I actually signed before I even went over to Europe the last time. Gotcha. Yeah, I think it was middle of August or so. I had told my agent that, you know, we do a 6 weeks world trip with the national team where you race every weekend before. And I told him, I'm like, yeah, I want this done before I go over there. I want to race without pressure. And I want to race just to win everything. You know, I don't want to have to be worried about a contract or anything. So we had it signed, done before I went to Europe. So I knew didn't have to worry about a team. And then from there, it's just, you know, really just 6 weeks of playing with my friends. We just, yeah. We went over, six of us. And I don't think we lost maybe two races.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty cool. When you did win Worlds, did contract stuff get weird? Like, were you fully committed legally, or could you? You were, yeah. So it didn't change anything.
No, signed contract, everything. It was
interesting.
I knew what I was doing.
Yeah,
for the next 2 years, anyways, and then I think they had been waiting just to announce it, just because you know it's kind of the game we play, and they were able to announce it that night after the race. So it was pretty cool to. First win a world title and then 2 hours later have it made public that you're going to the world tour.
For sure. Yeah. For sure. I assume it wasn't only Trek that was in the conversation. Obviously you don't have to get into details, but was there anything besides the financial side of things that kind of helped guide your decision? Was there anything you saw with that program that you found attractive?
I really liked the idea of racing for an American company. You know, I think, you know, at this point, you know, with Keel gone, I'm the only American rider, so it's not really so much, but, you know, I like racing with that flag. I like that it's registered here. And then, you know, if you look job security-wise with a company like Trek, you know, it's a really stable, you know, there's always going to be a team, you know, it's they have a long, long history of racing. And then you looked at their classics program and, you know, with guys like Mads Pedersen and Jasper, and at that time also John Degenkolb, you know, it was one of, you know, the best classics programs. You know, obviously wasn't at the time on the level of, say, Quickstep, but the idea of being a young American going to a Belgian team didn't sound that appeasing. So for me, as someone who wants to focus on the classics, I saw it as one of the top three classics teams, plus it was American registered. For me, really, once the offer came, I don't think we even negotiated the money. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure we just signed the first deal that came because it seemed like a place that I trusted. And then also, you know, knowing Matt was working within the team, just to have a little connection there and a little American support. And then also with Kiel as a mentor almost, you know, he's pretty much my roommate the entire season, just to have, you know, that a little second in perspective. You know, he knows what it's like to be homesick.
Yeah.
It was nice. I wouldn't have gone, if I went back, I wouldn't change anything. I was really happy to start my career here.
Yep. Yeah. Interesting. So speaking of Kiel, speaking of that, you know, actually diving in and doing the thing, I don't know where we want to start. Maybe not training camp. Let's say first, like, actual world tour race. What was different than you expected? Before we started recording, we talked a little bit about how, like, you've had this confidence. Like, as a junior, you went over to Europe. From the outside, it doesn't really seem like you were that intimidated. Like, all these big Belgian kids were, like, presumably doing their Euro thing where they're yelling at the Americans and leaning on them and stuff. And you leaned back and you were kind of like, nope, fuck you. I want to win this race. And there's a lot, like, the majority of American kids that go over and try to make it, like, don't have that attitude. Is that fair to say, by the way? I don't want to put, like, words in your mouth.
I think so. I think it's definitely a lot of the times the mentality around junior racing in the U.S., especially from the coaches and everything, is that, oh, you know, don't try too hard. You'll burn out. You know, don't train hard. Don't yell at people. Like, don't be aggressive. But, you know, it's just not going to work if you're trying to race at that high of a level. I mean, you see junior racing now, it's basically feeding the world tour. There's, you know, either first year or second year, so you go straight away. And it's really, really high level and really hard. And for me, you know, I wasn't interested in the, like, oh, I don't want to train super hard. I don't want to be aggressive. Like, it wasn't what I wanted to do. When I started being coached with Jim, I told him right away almost that, you know, my goal was to make straight to the world tour from juniors, and I wanted to be world champion. And I didn't really care how we got there or how hard the training was. And a lot of people, a lot of kids, my friends, my teammates, you know, even some of the directors that I was working with, you know, often told me, you know, I was doing too much or training too hard. And, you know, for me, you know, I fully trusted Jim's plan that we had, and, you know, I just really wanted to reach those two goals, and I didn't really care how hard it was or if it wasn't the right way to do it in other people's opinion.
Yeah, yeah. So then once you were in the world tour, like, did you have a similar attitude or did you get intimidated at points?
I definitely went in, you know, still with the same, like, really high goals and wanting to push myself there. And I think, you know, I'd always, before in racing, had always had my fitness to get me out of any problems. You know, if you miss them, you just jump, whatever, you jump across, it's fine. Yep. And then the first, like, world tour races you do, and you realize that, like, okay, everyone here is just as good as me. It's going to take a while to figure this out because, like, you miss the move, you're out of the race. It's like, you might as well go to the bus. You know, there's no more saving it. You got to be that good all the time. And then even straight away, you know, in February, I was doing these races in Mallorca that I had heard were just preparation races. And then you're setting your all-time power numbers going out the back. And I'm like, okay, God. this is going to be a bit more than I thought. And also that year, that first year, I made a lot of mistakes in my preparation and just how I trained and a lot of the stuff I did there. So I didn't really hit it at the level that I would have liked to, which it's hard to be confident when you know you're not that good. But then after everything kind of shut down with the corona break and everything, I had 2 months here to prepare. We changed some of my training and I came back and already then could feel in the races, I was a bit more competitive, and then you start to enjoy it more. Once you're racing at the front, it's really fun. When you're racing just to survive, it's not fun at all.
For sure. Speaking of COVID, how scary or frustrating was it to be in your first year? Like, you'd worked so hard to get to the World Tour, and then all of a sudden, of all things, there's a global pandemic. What the hell? What was that like? How frustrating was that?
Yeah, we were in Belgium at the time. I was living in Belgium because my coach and the team wanted me to get a better feel for the road. So I'd rented a place there for the whole spring. And we had just won opening weekend with Jasper. So the team was on it. You know, I raced not very well there. That was kind of a slap in the face. You know, it was my first World Tour one day, first classic, raining. There's some sleet, everything, just miserable. I crashed out on like the third cobbled sector or something, but you know, it makes you frustrated. So you want a chance to try again, and then you don't want to just leave. And then my brother actually came over because he was going to do the junior trip with the national team, but he was going to do a few Kermesse races staying with me before. And my mom was also over with him. And I think 5 days after they landed or something, we heard that all the races were canceled. And then one morning, the same morning we learned the races were canceled, the way I was woken up is I had a friend text me, just a random text out of the blue, "Are you going home?" And like, this was before we knew any, like, we were still being told from the team, we're racing, it's fine. And then we learned that, like, supposedly the U.S. border was being closed the next day or something, or 2 days later for flights from Europe. And then I saw that and I send it to my team. I'm like, "Guys, I think I need to go home." And they're like, no, it's okay. We'll still race. Like, Belgium was like, "You will just do no crowds, but it'll be okay for the bike racing." You do the, and then we find out like 2 hours later that the entire spring is canceled. And then they're like, "Okay, book the flights." So then me, my mom, and my brother flew out the next morning to back to here. And then from there we had, you know, 2 months of like hearing rumors that we'll start, but you know, and if you don't have a goal, it's really, really hard to train. So I was just here skiing, you know, trying to ride my bike a bit. And then we got like a provisional schedule of what we're supposed to start from the team. And from there, it's, you know, it's just back to work as normal for us almost. I mean, the whole isolation thing, I mean, being a bike racer is isolation. You don't see anyone.
That's true.
So I went, just three of us did a training camp in Park City again and just prepared for the racing and hit it back. You know, it was another whole big scandal just to get back into Europe of like getting permission from consulates, do this, like, how are we going to get in? Some countries were like, "No way." Then finally, my agent heard back from Spain that they were going to do an athlete provision. So we were able to fly over, and just flying over on an empty plane, just super weird. You hit the racing, no fans, everything. It was definitely a super strange first year.
Yeah. And then obviously you had another little false start late, which has been super well documented. We can touch on it more in a minute because I'm sure people would be mad if we pretended like it didn't exist. But I want to fast forward for a minute because basically between COVID and then you basically getting benched for Roubaix and the fall races, you go into 21. I mean, you had a couple of results in 2020. Like, I don't want to pretend like 2020 was a total write off, but it was just a super weird year overall.
Yeah.
And then going into 21, did you start to finally feel some pressure? Because you talked about earlier how you sort of, you know, made some contract decisions to be able to race like free and not race with pressure. But yeah, Going into 21, you're in a contract year. Did you feel like you were proving yourself at that point? Because everyone always talks about how like the hardest part isn't actually getting your first World Tour contract, it's getting your second one. Was that in the back of your mind at all going into 21?
No, because luckily, I think first I got to be super thankful to our team manager, Luca. You know, he's always been on my side and always, you know, kind of saw just what I can do on a bike and just seen that, you know, I haven't really sometimes gotten the chance to do it. So I talked with him already in January about staying with the team. and we had the contract negotiated pretty much done end of February of 21. And then I signed it actually at Torino that year in March.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah. I knew in my head, and like we had basically had a verbal agreement middle of the winter. You know, I knew I wanted to stay with the team.
Yep.
So, yeah, again, that was another thing. Again, I told my agent, you know, in December, I'm like, I don't want to be racing next year and not have a job already lined out. So,
yeah,
for me, I would prefer to do it early, even if you, you know, some guys like, oh, you'll do a big result and maybe miss out on some money. But for me, I'd rather not have the stress and know that, you know, I'm happy in my team. I want to stay here and then just race.
For sure. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, and that, I mean, in some ways, that did kind of happen because you won Tour de Wallonie. When was that? That was like
July,
so mid-year.
Would have been middle of July because, yeah, it was just after the tour.
Yeah, yeah. And then you were third at a stage in the Vuelta, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously very promising results. I don't know how World Tour contracts are negotiated, so I don't know how much of bargaining chips those would be, but I assume some. But it's interesting that you've continued to prioritize security, which, I mean, seems wise to me, especially at your age. Like, you've got so long to knock down big results.
I mean, it's almost, for me, it seems almost stupid not to when you see how quickly things change here. I mean, it's been four times now that I've come into good form and then not got to do anything with it.
Mm.
You know, I think, you know, last year I had a crash that, if hypothetically I don't sign until the end of the spring, and then, you know, you have a crash, you're off the bike again, then you're racing end of the year, then you're stressed. I probably don't win Wallonie if I'm there racing for a contract. You know, I was there just racing because I liked racing, and then that's when it goes well. As soon as I try and force myself to get something, I don't ever seem to go very well. But when I'm just there with the sole purpose of hurting other people's legs, it typically goes okay.
Totally. Yeah. And then you sort of had like a little non-conventional detour also by lining up for Unbound.
That is the reason why I was at Wallonie, because I was long list for the tour actually.
Mm.
And I think, you know, that was my focus for the whole summer. And then to crash at Unbound, take 10 days off the bike, then obviously, you know, no chance of even qualifying for the tour. And then you just have to restart and focus again along the path of like why I like the security part.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, let's talk about Unbound a little bit. I mean, obviously there's no like amazing race story to tell really, but I mean, that's kind of the nature of that race. It's almost like, I mean, obviously competitively it's super different than Roubaix, but I feel like it shares some similarities in terms of how much shit can happen and just like the chances of it going smoothly are very low.
Yeah, no, me and Kiel had such a dialed plan for it, and then we were both out of the race in 3 hours.
Yeah. So what was your impression? What is your impression of, you're an outspoken guy. I race gravel. Like, if you have critical things to say of gravel, I'm totally fine with it. I'd love to hear your honest assessment, because it's sort of a weird thing that's happening in cycling.
Yeah.
It's obviously, compared to the World Tour, a tiny segment of the sport, but the media gets really excited about it. You dipped a toe in, you got to kind of get a little bit of a taste of it. What were your impressions overall? Like, is that something you're curious about doing more of?
I like it. I mean, I do probably almost half my training on the gravel just out of enjoyment. And if it wasn't 2 weeks before the tour again, I'd be there again this year, because, you know, it's an event I'd like to do. I think, you know, the whole media circus around it is almost just kind of entertaining for me. Everyone kind of arguing about stupid stuff, it seems like, a lot of the time. You know, and they all talk about how like non-competitive and friendly it is. And I don't know, the first 3 hours of racing at Canada was pretty Unbound now, I guess, is pretty road racy almost. I mean, we're going into the first pinch point where me and Kiel had our super terrible team tactic plan of splitting the field. And it was a full on drag race for that, where it narrowed up there. I'm sure you remember.
Yep.
And then, you know, that you hear all this about like, oh, we wait for each other. And I'm telling you right now, I flatted and the front eight guys started rotating.
Yeah.
Like, I flatted, you know, I plugged the tire, put a CO2, no stress. Ah, it's gravel. They'll wait. And I look up, and I see the best eight guys in the race just full gas rotating, which they were not doing before I flatted. So
yeah.
I think this idea that it's all friendly, whatever. I mean, at the end of the day, there's a start line. You have a number plate on. A lot of us have bonuses for it. It's a bike race. And if you treat it like a bike race, I really like it. I think it's a super fun discipline, and it's good to be off the road. You know, I think it's safer in some way. I mean, you'll crash and cut yourself, but at least you won't get hit by a car. Honestly, and then, I mean, if they say that us racing it is kind of ruining the spirit or whatever, I don't agree with that, because a race like Unbound, it doesn't have that prestige. If a guy like Ted doesn't show up when he's in the World Tour, if, you know, Pete and Keel showed up as World Tour riders, Lachlan, Alex, they do it. It's the reason why it's the race that everyone wants to do.
Yep.
So there's no reason why we can't show up and race. And then also the 1,000 people there who just want to ride it, why they can't just ride it.
Totally. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And being in my position, like, it's so awesome to have the opportunity to test yourself against people that are of that level. It makes the racing a lot more fun, in my opinion. And it is such a unique, I mean, it's a pretty unique effort. Like, it's so long. I feel like that levels the playing field to an extent. And then also just all the shit that can happen. Like, it's just an unpredictable thing.
If it's for the top 15 guys or whatever that are there to try and win the thing, if you just embrace the fact that it's a race and that everyone's doing what they can to go the fastest, and we stop pretending like that's not why we're there.
Yeah.
Like, there's all this argument about aero bars or whatever, but at the end of the day, I didn't run them. There was guys who did run them. It's like, all that doesn't really matter, because at the end of the day, we're trying to go to the finish line the fastest, whether or not you hide that.
Totally.
Because you can go and do an interview saying it's all about the gravel spirit, but the truth is you just got back from a 5-hour interval session.
That, and I mean, there's people actually making real money now.
Yeah.
And I think it's so dumb to, and early on I was guilty about like talking down about aero bars too, just because I saw someone dislocate their shoulder right in front of me one time when they're in their aero bars going around a turn. I was like, well, that's kind of dumb, but like, people should be able to do whatever they want. Yeah. And yeah, the fact that there are people making very good money, but simultaneously trying to convince everyone that they don't care is a super weird dynamic.
I don't really understand why, because for me, not for this specifically, but for any race, like, the work I put into it has been like a point of, I'm always proud of knowing that I lined up doing everything I could to go the fastest you can.
Yeah.
So I don't really see the reason to hide that, because we're all competitors. We're all doing the same thing. And when it comes down to sprinting for the finish line, you know, if someone has aero socks on and they win by half a second, well, they still won the bike race. Like, you don't need to make fun of them for it.
Totally. Totally. What about mountain biking? We've got a couple of the best guys in the Peloton that moonlight now and then on dirt, obviously. Does that, I mean, not cross obviously, but mountain bike, does that interest you at all?
I want to do Leadville again. I want to win that race. You know, it's to come second. It's a bit frustrating still, you know, it's definitely, even no like money reason or nothing, just, or career progression. It's just, for me, I want to win that race. And then also, you know, someday it's really hard with how it lines up with the classics, but I'd really like to do Cape Epic.
Nice. Yeah.
And not just participate. Like, I'd like to do it with someone, and we like really built the winner around trying to win that.
How about Riley?
Talk to him. Trek?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I.
He doesn't put off much of a draft, but I feel like y'all could manage.
It would be fun, yeah. Especially, it's hard just because it's right before the classics. So if any crash or anything happens, then you're out from the most important races. It's
totally, yeah. So rather than rehash everything that people can go back and read about, I want to briefly touch on kind of, I guess, your growth as a professional. From first year to now third year, obviously you had the issue online where you got in a back and forth with this pretty well-known journalist on Twitter. That was kind of the thing that made the most headlines, but you've always been pretty outspoken. I know firsthand how easy it is for journalists to take things out of context. And like, there's a single sentence that you say amongst a an entire paragraph, and they're like, oh, this one sentence on its own would make a pretty good headline, and they throw it up there, and that puts you in a pretty weird position. That said, you've been in the media in some negative ways. Where do you stand on all that now? Like, how have you grown as a professional, I guess?
I think for me, you know, your first year in the Peloton, you know, it's almost exciting. You're always getting interviews, you know, you're getting new followers on Instagram, all this, like, whatever, you kind of get sucked into that. But what I've realized, especially this year, is I never raced my bike or wanted to race my bike so I could be in cycling news. Like, it's not the media for me is, I understand that it's part of the job, and for our sponsors, we have to do it. And, you know, you just accept it that way, but it's not really anything that I care about. You know, the more I race, the more I realize that, you know, forget the money, forget anything, you know, it's just because I want to win the biggest races in the world for me, not even for anyone else, really. Like, it's not to prove anything. It's to prove to myself that I can reach that level someday, hopefully. You know, it's not, I've changed my perspective on the media, and like, I kind of enjoyed, you know, that at first, but now for me, it's, you know, I just want to race my bike and I want to push myself as hard as I can, because, you know, I haven't felt like I've really gotten the chance to show the full potential and fully get everything out of myself. You know, there's been a few races, you know, like Strada this year is a race where it's like, okay, I did everything I could, and on that day I simply wasn't good enough. And to know that is actually way better than to have something else go wrong. And for me, that's why I race my bike, and it's why I train so hard, because I want to know, let's say I start next with Tour de Suisse, and if I finish there, whether or not I've won a stage, if I know that I did everything these 2 months to come back from being sick, you know, for me, that's why. If a journalist wants to ask a question about it, okay, you know, I have to do that for the team and for the sponsors and whatever. And I really enjoy, you know, having the fans and everything back at the races now that we're allowed to have spectators. And for me, that's the coolest part, is to interact with the people directly. You know, I don't like so much through the media. When you're at the bus and you get to meet with people, or they're cheering your name on the climbs, or, you know, you get a message on Instagram like, hey, I went out and rode my bike pretending to be you. Like,
yeah,
that stuff's really cool to me. And I love that. And I love, you know, being in Italy by the end of Tirreno, almost every single person on the road knew my name. And it was like, okay, this is like, they love this over here. Yeah. And for me, that part is cool. You know, I don't need it to come from a journalist trying to make a clickbaity story to prove to me that I'm a good bike racer. Like, I already know that I am.
Yep.
But I know that for myself, I want to be better, and I want it to be cool. You know, I don't want to be some boring road pro that everyone forgets. You know, I want to put on a show. I think, you know, on the third stage or so at Tirreno, when I was attacking alone, like, you know, you're going to get caught. You know, it'd be easy to sit in, whatever. But to add any race I do, if I can add a little bit of excitement, it's nice for me, and it's nice to see that people enjoy it and that they appreciate it, because let's face it, road racing can be quite boring sometimes. And if we can change that, we can have riders with a bit more personality who can, you know, show that both on the races and personally, you know, on their own social media or whatever, I think not only will it be better for the fans, but eventually, you know, it could turn to more money for all of us, especially as if we can grow the sport by being more entertaining and trying to monetize that.
For sure. Dude, it kind of sounds like you've done some media training.
I have done some media training.
I'm not hearing a whole lot of ums and ahs, and I'm hearing some pretty concise thoughts here. I'm impressed. So you mentioned Instagram DMs. This is totally from the heart. I have to assume it was very fucking hard during periods of time, during, you know, all the back and forth. I mean, I guess what I'm curious about is, like, how frustrating was it at times for people to think that they knew you at the time, this 19-year-old kid that, I mean, I don't know if you feel like it was a mistake, but I think a lot of people feel like, you know, you said something that pissed off a lot of people that maybe you would have been better off not saying, and you just happen to be under a massive amount of scrutiny very touted talent. What was it like to be on your phone on the receiving end of all that vitriol? Like, how hard was that? Were you able to compartmentalize it and put it out of your mind and just like go ride your bike and clear your head? Or what was that whole process like?
I was more upset. You know, if people are going to send you like pretty shitty messages, it's like, okay, whatever, dude. Like, I got a few, like, quite a few of like, oh, if I saw you out riding, I'd run you over with my truck and like just like stuff like that. It's like,
fuck,
you know, bro, whatever. Like, jeez, I was most upset that, you know, I'd felt like we have a really good classics group, and to be missing the races, you know, I was pretty disappointed to feel like I was letting them down. You know, I really wanted to be there just for them and for myself in the racing. And then, yeah, I mean, if someone wants to take the time out of their day to send you a message, just whatever. You know, I didn't even look at it for a while. I just went on a trip to Moab with my girlfriend, and then, you know, I came back November 1st, logged back onto my phone, and it's like, all right, it's time to train again. Yeah. And just moved on. You know, it's, you see it with any sports star, you know, there's always going to be people critiquing from the sideline, but 100%. Key part is they're there on the sideline and we're the ones out doing the work.
Yep. Fair enough. Cool. I got to ask you though, one other, not on that topic, but there was another headline where you said, this is as good as any Americans have ridden since the postal days. What about Seth, dude?
Well,
were you including him?
Yeah, they were talking.
That was another out of context thing, I'm sure.
That was another one where they just, whatever, did their cycling quote journalist thing. But yeah. No, it was, what I was saying was, you know, now if you run down the list, we have Seth winning stages of the Tour. Nielsen won San Sebastian last year.
Yeah.
Magnus just won last week. What else do we have? Jeez, it's a long list, actually. Lawson is riding super good as a, you know, kind of road captain for us Americans. We have, you know, guys winning smaller stage races. We have juniors who are going to be super good. We have Brandon, who's won 3 races this year.
When was the last? I knew that's what you meant. And so
when
that's
was
why
the last time we had a group of 8 of us who could win at a World Tour level?
Totally. And I knew that's what you meant. And yeah. The second I saw that cycling news article, I was like, for fuck's sake, man. And then, of course, there were people on Twitter that was like, what about Sepp? What about? I was like, I'm pretty sure
it's like, included.
He's in that conversation.
And it's not to discredit either the guys who were before that. Like, I mean, TJ was an amazing rider. There's been other amazing riders, but it's always been one amazing rider.
Yep.
This is the first time where, again, we have a group that's like, we could line up for world championships at the end of the year and actually have a shot, an outside shot, but at least a shot at winning it.
Super true.
Who was the American team 5 years ago? There was always 1, 2, 3 good, really good pros, but we never had the depth that now, you know, we could go to Australia this year with 6 guys and have a goal at trying to win it. You know, the same was in Leuven last year. We had 6 riders and we were there to actually try and win the bike race at a world championship. Americans haven't done that in a long time.
Very true. What do you think is contributing to that? Like, why do you think there is that depth now?
I don't know really. I think, you know, a lot of it, there's not enough credit given to the junior national team that there was. It's gone now, which is actually super sad. But, you know, if you look at the guys in the World Tour who are under Billy's program, it's almost all of us came through that national team that was racing a lot in Europe, a lot more than other guys. And now, you know, the team like Lux or Hot Tubes, where companies are actually spending money on getting juniors racing in Europe. You know, it's changed. And the mentality too, you know, especially among guys around like my age, you know, with the Magnus and Sean Quinn also is riding good already today. And then even my brother coming up now, plus all the guys who are 2, 3 years older than us, you know, a guy like Mateo, who's super good, a guy like Brandon, who's won 3 races already this year. Nielsen's only 2 years older than us. We're all within 5 years or so of each other. So it's almost a competition now that's forming that, like, okay, gee, like if we want to go to Worlds as American, it's no longer a shoe-in just because you have World Tour on your logo, on your jersey. Like, yeah,
great point.
You know, the more that we can all push each other, and make, you know, uncomfortable in a good way. Like me and Magnus were in Park City together last year. And when we train together, it's hard. It is like, there's definitely we want to be better than each other. But then at the same time, like to see him win is also super cool.
Yeah. What was it like to see him win a couple weeks ago?
It was like, I think everyone who knows him knew it was coming, but maybe not that soon. So it's definitely a surprise that he got it figured out that quick. But again, it's super cool. And then, you know, it's another really big, strong American engine that we have to use in the future.
Yeah. I mean, I know how it is to have peers win. Like, yeah. There's a certain jealousy involved.
Can,
of course,
because you want to be there. How can you watch Sepp win a Sage of the Tour and not also want to win a Sage of the Tour?
It's... Of course. So what was that ratio of, like, stoke to jealousy when Magnus won?
It's probably 50-50.
Yeah.
I think, that's fair. I think, you know, if you asked him the same question, it'd probably be the same the other way. I think, you know, as juniors, when we were on opposite teams, it would get like pretty nasty sometimes how hard we go at each other.
Interesting.
But then the next weekend we could race with the national team and we're first and second. It's just, you know, it's a super, in my opinion, healthy competition. And, you know, in training you can push each other, and in racing, just knowing that there's someone else, you know, on your level, you know, it's stops everyone from getting comfortable. You know, as soon as we start getting comfortable in our position, you know, within the national team or within your own team, you know, you're not going to progress anymore.
Yep. Let's talk about Colby real quick. Your younger brother, he signed with the Jumbo Devo team this year. Yep. Over in Europe. What's it like having your brother over there? How much do you get to see him, and how much are you able to kind of give him a hand and finding the ropes a little bit? Cause he's doing like very hard races already. It looks like.
No, it was nice. I have an apartment in Girona now. So to have him, you know, there staying with me when I was over is, you know, I think it helps both of us. And then, you know, for him, it's been kind of a hard transition just because, you know, his first year as a junior with Corona, there was no racing with the national team. And then the second year, USA Cycling fired Billy, who was directing it, and then didn't do any national team blocks. So all his racing in Europe was just with Lux, and it was at a not lower level, but it wasn't quite the Nations Cup level that we were always used to racing at as a junior. So really his only top level race was the World Championships. So to go straight from that into already high level U23 racing on a team like Jumbo, it's going to be super hard, but yeah, I mean, he'll be good. He's got the fitness, and as soon as he starts figuring out how to do the races, you know, there's not going to be any problems.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think it is about your family? Like, I mean, obviously there's physical talent involved, but you grew up in the mountains. I use your dad, I mean, not frequently, but now and then, as an example of kind of like the classic Durango Tuesday Night Worlds guy who like has a normal job, doesn't worry too much about the equipment he's on.
Yeah.
Pretty sure he doesn't bother shaving his legs, but just smashes and would like anywhere else in the country be like the top masters dude. I know your mom spends a lot of time in the mountains also. When you're taking a break, you know, people can see updates of y'all, you know, doing ski-mo together and even some like rock climbing and stuff, right? Yep. Talk to me a little bit about kind of your upbringing, and just sort of, I don't know what, like if there were any values that your family instilled in you in regards to like hard work and, you know, ambition and all that sort of thing. Cause all of y'all are kind of assassins out there in the outdoors.
Yeah. I think talking about dad on the group rides, his favorite thing to do is like, especially when I was 14, 15, like me and him were pretty much on the same level, and like Tuesday night was like that was the World Championships every weekend for us in the household. But yeah, his favorite thing to do would be to like work all day and then do the group ride, and then like if I beat him on the group ride, you'd hear, well if all those guys were working as hard as me, I would be winning. But no, it's always been, and then Colby gets involved once he's a bit older, and then it's the three of us going at each other. But I think from the start it's always been a competition thing. You know, there's no way I was going to let dad beat me at anything. There's no way I was going to let Colby beat me at anything. And I think they felt the same, just inverse. And, you know, you always you know, whether it was playing Uno or going on the group ride or going skiing, or me and my brother skiing at the ski resort, you know, everything was a flat out competition no matter what. And I mean, I loved it. I think it's super fun. And to have that, you know, with them, it's, you know, there's almost the best memories on a bike are like the three of us racing on a group ride or like doing a bike packing trip with Dad, where like, you know, you can just, he'll come with me on these 6-day rides or whatever. He spends the entire 6 days just back there swinging. And I'm like, well, I guess if he can suffer that much, I can finish my training ride. And then, you know, with the, if you relate it to physical, I mean, anytime you're born at 6,500 feet, you're going to have somewhat of an advantage in some way. So to be born here is, you know, really a huge gift if you're trying to be a bike racer. And then you grow up where the normal thing to do is you ride your bike in the summer and you ski in the winter. You're going to be a pretty fit kid eventually. So if I can combine, you know, the physical talents my dad has with my mom's, you know, almost like OCD level to train, because that, you talk about Dad, the reason why I always would say wouldn't make a very good bike racer is because of the way he shows up, not caring about his equipment, not like being super dialed, just smashing. And then, you know, my mom's the opposite of that. And then if you combine the two of those, the physical and then the mental, into me and my brother, you know, you suddenly have two people with physical gifts, but then also enough OCD to do 10 laps up Edgemont, which, if we're honest, isn't that fun. But like, you have to do it if you want to be a bike racer. Yeah. And then you add in, like, you must win competition to the top of that. Yeah. I don't know. We probably annoy a lot of people, but for the three of us, it's really fun.
Yeah, the group rides, the group rides can get a little spicy, just like competitively, where it's like, God, honestly, like, Colby and Quinn are just going to tag team us all night. This is
No, it's always hard. It's like a fun mix for me of like making sure to chase Colby down, but do it in a way that like I can keep the group together, because like he'll attack, I'll bring everyone up, but by bringing everyone up, I've dropped Dad. So then I got to go back off the back and push him up. And then suddenly you do this for an hour and a half, and like I'll finish just a Tuesday group ride with 10 of us and have a normalized power of like 390 for an hour and a half. And it's just so much fun because, you know, I'm having fun harassing Colby, chasing him, having fun, you know, like putting Dad on the limit. And then everyone else is kind of like stuck in this weird, kind of probably annoyed with us, but like,
no, it's good.
It's always been fun. So,
yeah. And I mean, there's such good depth these days too. Yeah. The level like Riley's riding at, and it's good. Speaking of OCD, you're right. We said 4 o'clock, and I think you showed up at like 3:59:45. I was pretty impressed.
I try. Well, that's another thing that changes in the world tour. If you're late to the bus is going to leave you.
Really?
Yeah.
Even if you're like Mads or Nibali, obviously he's not on your team.
Well, Nibali never really showed up on time, but he's just Italian.
Yeah.
But no, it's definitely it's not the laid back mountain bike scene.
Yeah.
You're like, you got to be on it.
Makes sense. I wanted to play a quick little game here at the end. At the beginning, you sort of mentioned it, but we're going to go kind of a little deeper here. I want you to rank the priority with which you'd like to win these races.
Okay.
So we have a stage of the tour, world champs, Roubaix, Olympic road race, or curveball. Second on, this is sort of like fantasy land. I could see you losing a couple kilos maybe in one day. Because, I mean, back in the day, Lance, like, was heavier, and then he leaned out. Yep. He was more your style rider, and then became a GC rider. So we've seen it happen. But stage of the tour, world champs, Roubaix, Olympic road race, or second on GC at the Tour de France? In a hypothetical world.
It's funny you talk about that, because actually, my team doctor, we've talked before about, like, what would happen if I lost some of my baby fat. So,
dude, you don't have any baby fat. I've actually, sorry to interrupt, but this is an interesting topic. Where would you, because Wout did a really interesting interview with Geraint. Do you ever listen to Geraint's podcast?
I've listened to a few, yeah.
Yeah, so he did a really interesting podcast with Wout, and Wout was talking about riding for GC one day, and just how training would change, and like, it was pretty interesting. So I'm curious about that. Tell me your thoughts on that.
Personally, if I made like a long-term plan, I'd like to try eventually.
Yeah.
You know, I think Garrett, you saw he was a classics racer, and then 10 years later he wins the tour. You know, I think being from altitude and just, you know, the VO2 and lactate numbers that I know I do push, I know if I could lose, you know, I'd have to be a significant amount of body mass. But if in long term I could do that, you know, I think for me it'd be a fun challenge. You know, I'm not going to say 3 week races, but, you know, to spend, you know, 4 or 5 years from now or whatever to say like I'm going for GC at Torino or Tour de Suisse or something, I think for me that'd be a really fun challenge, you know, and something I've definitely thought about wanting to do. And, you know, we just know from objectively looking at my fat measurements and everything that there is quite a lot of room to improve.
How would that work? Like, how, like, why would you be carrying fat right now when you are doing 25, 30 hour weeks all the time? Is it just, I mean, like,
it's, I'm still only 20 at the end, you know,
okay,
it's,
yeah, fair.
You know, it's by the time you're 28 and you've done 8 grand tours and, you know, it's hard. I probably lost, you know, just 1% of body fat almost just from one Vuelta. And that, you know, it's just each year I've done, you know, I have my charts. I can see that it's slowly coming down as I get older. And, you know, we can do the math. You know, it's not hard. The guys, our doctors know at which level, how far you can push it and at how much barrier I have. And I think last time I checked, I had something like 4 or 5 kilos of just purely fat I could lose and still be at a healthy weight where I didn't lose any muscle mass.
That's crazy.
So if I do that, it puts me already at 68 kilos or something. And then if you can hold the same power there and you do the math on the watts per kilo, it's like, okay, then you're going pretty good.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. So sorry. Okay. Sort of digressed.
Yeah.
Stage of the tour, world champs, Roubaix, Olympic road race, second on GC at the tour.
For sure it has to be world champion because, you know, I mean, the other classics are so special, you know, you would never turn down a Flanders or a Roubaix or a Strahd or anything, but to have that jersey for a whole year. And then again, if you tie it back to liking to do it as an American, you know, when was the last time one of us got to wear that jersey? I can't think of it as an elite.
Lance.
If you count Lance, then Lance. Yeah.
Dude, you got to count Lance. Don't get me started on that. That's a whole other topic. We're counting Lance.
Okay. Perfect. Then, yeah, I mean, it was, did LeMond win? He won as a junior. I know he was the last junior winner before me, but I don't know if he ever won as an elite.
I don't know.
So that'd be pretty cool to bring that jersey back here.
Yeah. Yeah, honestly. Okay, second.
Second.
Cycling's weird in that I think everyone would pick a rainbow jersey over an Olympic gold medal.
I mean, yeah, if you just...
Isn't that weird?
You get that jersey. That's so special. And then, I mean, even you could look at the bonus. I think the bonus for being a world champion, you know, it means the most to companies. It means the most for visibility. Like,
for sure, like professionally. But like, it's interesting just societally. Like if you went and told 10 random people on the street, like I'd rather have this white shirt with a rainbow on it versus an Olympic gold medal, they'd be like, oh, that's a weird sport.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something. It just, you're world champ. You can't beat that.
Yeah. Agreed. Totally agreed. All right.
Second place. Second. I mean, I never see myself as a podium rider at the tour. So I'd have to pick Roubaix. You know, if it was a possibility, I think, you know, no matter who you are, you want to stand on the tour podium. But, you know, I don't think that's even worth putting on there for me. So I'd go Roubaix. Then what were the others?
Olympic road race or a stage of the tour.
Stage of the tour, then the Olympics.
Yep. In a hypothetical world, world champs, I think this is a really dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. World champs or winning the tour?
World champs or winning the tour?
Yeah. Really? You have to think about that. Interesting.
That's a hard one.
Interesting.
You thought I'd pick tour.
For sure. Just because it transcends the sport more. But I also get like, I don't know. What do you think is speaking professionally, like, what do you think is bigger from a salary standpoint, world champion or tour? Because that dumb article came out where they tried to rank everything and everyone knew the salaries were wrong. Yeah. So it's like maybe Pogacar, but.
I mean, I think it's probably a safe guess that Pogacar is the highest paid rider in the world.
Yeah.
And he's the one who won the tour. So I guess that financially answers the question.
But I feel like Sagan is pretty close to what.
Yeah, for sure.
Pogacar is making.
Sagan also.
Yeah, true.
That's, I don't know that. I've never, like I said, saw myself as a GC at the tour rider. So just like the dream, emotionally, I'd rather be world champion. Financially, of course, you win the tour and you're set for life, but yeah. I still want to be world champion.
Cool, man. I think that's a good place to cap it. Appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm really stoked for people to be able to hear from you. There's plenty of other stuff we could have talked about. Could have talked about a white rim return. Could have talked about...
It's in the plans.
Is it? Good.
Eventually.
Good.
My plans keep changing, but...
Where are you going to start from? That's the big question.
That's the surprise, huh? Few people guessing.
The thing at this point is like, yeah, you can start at the bottom of Schaefer, but then you don't get the Strava segment.
Thing is now, too, physiologically I've changed that I don't think it'd be any faster.
Really? I also wonder, like, if you're really well-trained and you pace it perfectly, technically doing Schaefer last is faster because you're lighter.
Yeah, it's faster. And because if you went real technical, you want the higher power load at the end because otherwise you're carrying that effort the whole day.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. It's just so fucking miserable to hit that climb 5 hours in after doing
I wouldn't. TT. I wouldn't do, I was talking to Keegan last week about doing it, and I wouldn't do his method of like as light on water and food and everything as possible. I think I would be going heavier, carry a proper amount of water and make sure to have the power because if you put it through a simulator, power beats saving the weight.
Yeah. Cause at the end of the day, it's not actually that climby.
No. So, I mean, 6,000 feet in 100 miles is not really anything.
Yeah, and 2/3 of it,
yeah,
is on, or 1/3 of it is on that last climb.
Yep. Yeah,
it's an interesting one. Keegan wants to, he probably talked to you about this also, but just for fun, do like a fully optimized one.
Yep.
Where he starts with like
5 hour white rim.
Yeah, gravel bike at the bottom of Schaefer, does a bike change. I feel like you could go sub 5.
I would do start. Close. I would start halfway up the climb on a gravel bike.
Why?
Because it's a 20-minute climb about. A 10-minute effort at the start, you're not going to feel. And no matter how tired you are, you can do 10 minutes flat out at the finish.
Yep. Interesting.
And then you have the gravel bike for the majority of the climb, the pavement, the fast dirt, and then you switch to the mountain bike when you need it. And then you do a 10-minute climb on the mountain bike versus gravel bike.
Yep.
You're that tired, it doesn't matter.
I think really conditions are the biggest thing at the end of the day.
And you definitely need feeds. Well,
oh, to go
sub 5.
Yeah.
Because to go out there and just dehydrate yourself is not that.
Dude, that's what great. I did the first time. I know Jeff Kabush did that too.
Yeah.
It was insane. My heart rate was literally at VO2 for an hour. It was like so sketchy.
No, I mean, there's a reason why we take on 2 bottles an hour in 6 hour races.
Honestly. Anyway, any other FKTs? Like long, big picture? I know you don't really have time, but.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of annoying almost. Like all the stuff that's been going on here is actually stuff I'd like to do. You know, I think like the Lifetime Series or anything, all that just from an enjoyment and liking racing my bike, it's something I want to do. It just doesn't really fit in yet, but. Also, was talking to Keegan about this one would be a course record at Leadville.
Because
I think that's one, you know, it's sure it's a climbing race, but at the end of the day, a big guy is going to push power and get it because you need to go so fast on the flats.
Yeah.
So I think that'd be a cool one to try and do.
You'd need, I feel like, I don't know. It seems like you'd need to have a couple of guys with you, like Albon did it, like a couple other committed people.
You need 4 people probably.
Yeah. And they made it a little longer now.
This makes it more fun.
Yeah. I think it's two miles longer. I can't remember. Yeah.
No FKTs really, but I'd like to eventually do, you know, all the big American gravel races just to do them. You know, if my fitness wasn't so bad, I'd probably go to BWR this weekend just because I like doing that stuff. But yeah, in terms of FKT is nothing.
Dude, you should do BWR anyway. I mean, I know it's hard when, like, you know, you're riding 5%, 10% below what you usually would, but
it's just so far. That's the worst part about Durango is we're so far from everything.
Yeah, it is really isolated. Yeah. It's a blessing and the curse because we're not getting absolutely destroyed by tourists like some of the other Colorado cities, but still, I hear you. All right, we could ramble on, but thanks for driving up. Appreciate you making the trek up into the woods here.
Yeah, thank you.
And good luck with the comeback. It's been pretty fun watching you this spring, and can't wait to see what you do this summer. Tour, hopefully.
Hopefully, yep.
Sweet.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
Hello again. Thank you all so much for listening. Also, big thank you to Therabody and their all new Recovery Air Jet Boots. They just sent them out. They're super trick. They feel so good. My training is ramping up officially now. My healing is coming along quickly. Racing feels like it's coming up even faster. And what that means is I'm putting in the training full blast again, full speed. And that means I'm starting to think a lot about recovery. And Therabody's new Recovery Air Jet Boots are part of my daily recovery routine. These Recovery Air Jet Boots are the world's most advanced pneumatic compression system ever. Obviously, for years, runners, bikers, and everyone who spends hours on their feet have had to suffer through leg pains and aches after long, hard days. Clinically proven treatments like the compression boots pro athletes have always used have been out of reach for most people, but no longer. Recovery Air's new Jet Boots provide a groundbreaking pressure massage for honestly everybody, anywhere. They're totally wireless, which makes them super mobile, really convenient. And they have an exclusive fast flush technology, which flushes out metabolic waste more fully and brings back fresh blood to your legs at 3 times the speed of competitors. Obviously, faster cycles means faster recovery, so you don't have to wait for your legs to start feeling great. Therabody's recovery boots are the first of their kind. They're truly wireless, like I said, so you can take them anywhere, recover quickly, and they have super sweet, intuitive, easy-to-use one-touch controls as well. And shout out NBA. NBA All-Star Paul George uses them exclusively as well. So cool. So sit back, relax, and recover. Go to therabody.com/adventure to get your Therabody Recovery Air today, starting at just $6.99. That's wild when you compare it to what prices were just even a couple of years ago. You can also get them for just as low as $59 a month with Affirm. There's no risk with a 60-day money-back guarantee and free shipping. Just go to therabody.com/adventure. Big thanks also to Dometic for supporting the podcast. At the top of the show, I mentioned their new water hydration jug, this 11-liter hydration jug that Nicole and I just ordered to have on hand at the races at the expo area, and we're pairing it with their new really cool hydration water faucet. One thing that's really attracted me to Dometic is their mindfulness in regards to environmentally friendly products and habits. Why do you need a specialized faucet for, you know, a camping water jug? Well, it helps you dispense just the amount of water that you need, so you're not, you know, accidentally dumping a bunch of water on the ground in the middle of the desert or something. Whether you're brushing your teeth or washing pots and pans, whatever it is, we're really excited to start using this water jug, 11-liter water jug, along with the self-powered hydration water faucet. Pretty cool technology. It doesn't have any sort of, you know, complicated motors or pumps or anything like that. Really sleek, easy to use. And just one more way that we're kind of optimizing our setup for this year. Last week, I talked a lot about their new camp chairs and tables. We put a big order in for that as well. And yeah, we're just going to be tricked to the nines for this race season and kind of the non-race weekends as well. We're really looking forward to taking our setup into the backcountry to decompress and unplug now and then as well. If y'all are interested in bolstering your summer outdoor setups, whether, you know, whatever your needs are, whether you're a tent camper, whether you're a van lifer, whether you're an RVer, Dometic has something for everyone. All you have to do is go to Dometic.com, click on their outdoor line of products, and use code AdventureStash and get yourself 15% off anything in their outdoor category, which is a lot of options. Really cool stuff. That's Dometic.com, code AdventureStash for 15% off. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing the show every week. We will catch you next week.